As President Trump looks to build a bigger wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, Mexican cartels are working to improve drug smuggling tunnels into America. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Sophisticated drug smuggling tunnels cost $1 to $2 million to build, but experts say the cartels can make that money back on just the first run. Jean Guerrero of KPBS traveled to Otay Mesa on the border, where she got a firsthand look at how these tunnels are engineered.
It's going to go with you, all right?
I'm hooked to a harness, about to go 90 feet underground with the Border Patrol's drug tunnel entry team, or as they call themselves, tunnel rats.
I'm gonna chew gum, by the way, just so you know.
Lance Lenoir is our captain. He wears a brown shirt with a big cartoon rat on the back.
What we do is assess the tunnel, characterize it, go in, pull out evidence, map it, get rid of it.
By get rid of it, he means they plug the drug tunnels up with cement. But this one, named Galvez Tunnel, was left partly intact to train the tunnel rats. U.S. federal agencies found the tunnel in 2009, before it was finished. Cartels had built it to smuggle things like pot and cocaine into the U.S. Lenoir tells me to hold on tight to the ladder as we descend, though I am fastened to a tether.
So if I fall, it'll catch me?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that will allow it.
Okay, sounds good.
We head into the tunnel.
It's just a ladder.
All right.
Deep inside the ground, the tunnel is about 6 feet high and 4 feet wide, with sandstone walls. It's relatively comfortable, although it's warm and humid.
This is like the Cadillac of tunnels. It's tall, it's wide, very stable geology.
Border Patrol classifies it as a sophisticated tunnel. It has lights and ventilation, and used to have a rail system to move drugs. It stretches hundreds of feet underground. There are other kinds of tunnels. Rudimentary tunnels, known as gopher holes, stretch maybe 50 feet. And interconnecting tunnels exploit storm drains and sewers.
This one in particular was hit underneath a bathroom floor that actually raised and lowered to get in and out. We've seen elevators, bona fide elevators, you know, with up and down buttons in there, everything but the muzak.
Despite its sophistication, tool marks along the walls show it was made with a mere hammer drill.
Pure manual labor, blood, sweat, and tears.
Nearly 200 cross-border drug tunnels have been found since 1990, when the first one was discovered. David Shirk of the Transborder Institute says criminal organizations like the Sinaloa Cartel began building them in response to border fence construction.
So the more sophisticated and elaborate our border infrastructure has become, the more the smugglers have upped their game.
Shirk says plans to expand the border fence could increase tunneling if enough new miles are built. He says cartels are going as far as consulting with top engineers in Europe to perfect the tunnel architecture.
And they have every incentive to do so. If it costs $1 million or $2 million to produce a tunnel like that, they can make that back on the first run.
Most of the sophisticated tunnels are being found around San Diego. That's because there's so many warehouses in Otay Mesa, providing a perfect way to disguise exit and entry points. The Galvez Tunnel runs under Otay Mesa. Back outside, Lenoir says drug tunnels are getting harder to find. Cartels are making them smaller.
Now they're ranging anywhere from 36 inches in diameter to about a little less than 4 feet.
To find the tunnels, the U.S. relies on leads from informants, people who perhaps notice suspicious jackhammer sounds or large piles of dirt. But Border Patrol is working to improve tunnel detection technology.
Right now, it's lacking. I mean, we're talking about a niche problem in here that's not really, does have any parallel to the commercial or industry standard.
Existing sensor technology gets thrown off by surface clutter and noise, and there's a lot of cross-border traffic in this area. The mixed geology, porous, sandy, rocky, also makes it hard to see what's underground. Lenoir says he doesn't know if plans to expand the border fence will affect tunneling. But the cartels keep getting more creative in making their tunnels. And he says he wants to make sure the U.S. gets more creative in finding them. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
This week, Houston joined San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, El Paso, and El Cenizo in suing the state of Texas over SB4, the Sanctuary Cities Law. SB4 goes into effect in September, but the rules are currently about as clear as mud for when Texas law enforcement officials must detain immigrants who may be here illegally. The new state law will require them to hold immigrants for as long as federal authorities request. But a recent judge's ruling says there has to be probable cause that the immigrant has committed a crime. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy talked with Bexar County officials about how they're navigating these murky waters and what they learned from a case where an immigrant was held for months.
When Bexar County held Mexican immigrant Julio Trujillo for more than 72 days in its jail, it wasn't because of the charges for which he was stopped. Those charges had already been dropped. Instead, Bexar County held Trujillo for more than 2 months because federal immigration officials requested it because they believed Trujillo might be in the country illegally. This month, San Antonio Federal District Judge Orlando Garcia ruled that Bexar County, under former Sheriff Susan Parmalo, had violated Trujillo's constitutional rights by keeping him in jail without having a reason to believe that he had committed a crime. Garcia said a belief that Trujillo might be in the country illegally wasn't enough to hold him in jail. Bexar County Sheriff Javier Salazar says he's now handling immigrant cases differently.
ICE detainers in and of themselves don't necessarily rise to the level of probable cause. So we're working with the DA's office and we're going to be in communications with ICE on a case-by-case basis to make sure that each and every detainer either rises to the level of probable cause, in which case we'll, you know, work with ICE. But if it does not rise to the level of probable cause as determined by the district attorney's office, that person will have to be released.
Sheriff Salazar says knowing what the law requires of local officials isn't clear. On one hand, immigration agents ask them to detain people who may be here illegally. A federal judge says you can't hold them unless there's probable cause that they've committed a crime. Then a new state sanctuary cities law says that as of September 1st, you must detain individuals for as long as immigration agents request.
We're in a minefield, and we're definitely in a tough position. Now, that's what we signed up for, knowing that full well, but it is. It's a tough situation that we're being placed in, and I, for one, want some answers, some solid answers.
Salazar says that he opposes the state's new sanctuary cities ban because it ties the hands of local law enforcement leaders.
Right now, undocumented immigrants are not who's committing crimes in Bexar County. It's U.S. citizens that are committing crimes in Bexar County. And so I think as a local official, I'm a lot better equipped to determine what it is that I need here locally. And I think SB 4 throws a big wrench in that.
But in September, Salazar could risk losing state grant money, his job, and possibly end up in jail if he doesn't honor federal immigration requests. His hope, and that of Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf, is that the opponents of the new sanctuary cities law can stop it before it goes into effect. Wolf says that's why Bexar County has joined a lawsuit.
The legislature cannot put him in jail if this law violates the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution is much more important and overrules the state, overrules the governor, overrules the lieutenant governor.
Wolf says that Bexar County loses money every time it holds an immigrant for federal officials because the federal government only reimburses the county for a fraction of its cost. Judge Wolf says the county has spent over $22 million over the last 12 years to detain immigrants, and it's not local law enforcement's responsibility.
We shouldn't even be involved. This is a federal law, immigration law. 40% of the people that are here and still have not been documented didn't come into the country illegally. And so it's largely a civil matter. Now, those that committed a crime, that's a different deal.
Next Monday, a federal judge who ruled in the Trujillo case will hear the first lawsuit hoping to prevent the implementation of the state's new sanctuary cities law. Bexar County is joined by the cities of San Antonio and Austin and others in filing the case. Sheriff Salazar hopes the outcome will remove the uncertainty plaguing local law enforcement being asked to detain immigrants and make it clear that immigration control is not the job of local officials. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
Now to West Texas, where ranchers are broadening their income streams to keep their cattle operations afloat. Marfa Public Radio's Zoe Kurland reports some of those ranchers are finding financial stability in nature-related tourism.
The Miller family bustles around the kitchen in their home on the C.E. Miller Ranch, just outside of Valentine in far West Texas.
The stories of this ranch, well, there are many.
Jody Miller, the family matriarch, has lived on the ranch for almost 70 years. The walls, tables, even windowsills are blanketed with family photos and awards won for excellence in land stewardship and resource management. But Jody's life didn't start like this.
I was supposedly a city girl raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
She didn't know ranch life until she met Clay Miller.
They bought this place in 1925. Clay was born in 26. We married in 49. We lived without electricity when we first married. get out and stumble around in the dark and find the right switches to pull, the right pump to pump.
The late Clay Miller and his father before him kept a meticulous log of rain records on a large sheet of paper. His son, Bill Miller, continues the tradition.
We live in a desert or a perpetual drought.
Him kept a meticulous
the right pump to pump.
The late Clay Miller and his father before him kept a meticulous log of rain records on a large sheet of paper. His son, Bill Miller, continues the tradition.
We live in a desert or a perpetual drought interrupted by an occasional flood. That's basically the way it works.
Bill points out a 2-year stretch when the rainfall was particularly low, a drought that spanned from 2010 to 2012. 5 years later, Jill Miller, Bill's wife, says the family is still trying to bounce back.
So you have less cows, and of course you have less grass, in order to keep your land in some kind of shape so it can come back, you start selling cattle.
The Millers went from 500 cows to 75 cows. Left with only a fragment of their original herd, the Millers had to find new ways to combat rising costs while still maintaining their cattle operation. And they're one of many ranching families getting creative to avoid selling land they've owned for generations. Ryan O'Shaughnessy, professor of agricultural business at Solross State University, says this is very common.
Your truly successful cattle ranchers are good businessmen. And I'm sure most of those guys will say, yeah, I'm a good businessman first and a cowboy second.
6 hours to the east, I meet David Langford, who's one such rancher. Langford's the former CEO of the Texas Wildlife Association and currently operates a portion of his family's ranch outside of San Antonio. Langford's relatives have worked that land for 7 generations.
It was founded by my great-grandfather in 1885. He imported 3 Angus cows from Scotland in 1890, and all the cattle on this ranch go back to those same 3 cows.
But back in the mid-90s, selling that beef wasn't paying the bills, and Langford wanted other options. So, in 1997, Langford put together a statute with the Texas legislature that made it easier for ranchers to open their land to nature-related tourism. Hiking, hunting, camping, and more. Langford says this significantly changed how his family and other ranchers make their money.
20, 30, 40% of their income from their ranching operation in any given year probably comes from hunting and other sorts of nature-related tourism.
That's true for the Millers, who say that now almost a third of their income comes from hunting tours. Hunts on their property can cost up to $4,000. Other ranches charge up to $8,000. Sounds like a lot, but Solross's Ryan O'Shaughnessy says even if a ranch sells about 6 or 7 hunts a year, bringing in $30,000 to $35,000 more, that money is just making ends meet. While nature-related tourism may be popular, some ranchers are wary of letting people on their land. Langford says some of his relatives who operate other portions of his family's ranch won't do it.
Listen, I have family members that think hunters are a bunch of foolishness. They get underfoot, but we don't want to fool with them.
But for some, fooling with them is the only option. The Millers say they're not against getting onto a site like Airbnb and plan to expand their ecotourism ventures to rentals. And if any visitors do make trouble, Jody Miller has the solution.
Run them off.
That was Zoe Kurland for the Texas Standard. Coming up next on Fronteras, some Texas students are crossing ocean borders because of their goal ball skills.
It's where we get to verse the best players from all over the world, from every country.
That story and some thoughts about what the number one hit song Despacito tells us about the United States. After this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. This month, 4 students from the Texas School for the Blind and Visually Impaired in Austin are heading across the Atlantic Ocean to Hungary. The Texas Standard's Becky Fogel reports they're among a handful of Americans selected to compete in the Goal Ball World Youth Championships.
One of those students is 17-year-old Davian Perez. He says this summer's tournament is like a version of the Paralympics.
It's where we get to verse the best players from all over the world, from every country, and we all get put into one place and we just go at each other.
In goalball, a sport played by athletes who are blind or visually impaired, there are 2 teams on a volleyball-sized court. Each team has three players, and they're spread out to guard the goal, which stretches the entire width of the court.
And the object of the game is to get a 1.5-pound ball with bells inside of it, the size of a basketball. You try and roll that as fast as you can to the other side of the court and try and get it over that, you know, over the other team.
That ball sounds like this. Mark Gronquist coaches the boys and girls teams at the school, which each came in second at Youth Nationals this year. He says World War II veterans started the sport in the 1950s.
They're trying to create like a team sport that was physical. And that's when it started, and it's kind of evolved over the years. In 76, it became a Paralympic sport, and these four kids are going to be on track to be Paralympians.
Like Perez, Talia Woodard is also headed to Hungary in June. She loves the sport and has a message for anyone who might think people who are blind or visually impaired can't do something like this.
We might not be able to drive a car or ride a motorcycle, but, you know, we do have a sport that we love, just like anybody likes football or basketball. And, you know, goalball is our sport, and they should really check it out.
The Goalball World Youth Championships start June 30th. In Austin, I'm Becky Fogel.
The smash hit song Despacito has taken the airwaves by storm. It's already held number one on the Billboard Hot 100 for a number of weeks. It hit 2 billion views on YouTube a week ago after its launch in January, believed to be faster than any other clip in YouTube history. Commentator Yvette Benavides notes that the success of the Spanish language song is an important signal about America that's changing underneath our dancing feet.
Maybe by now everyone's heard about the seismic popularity of the song Despacito by Puerto Rican singer Luis Fonsi. You can hear the ubiquitous infectious tune everywhere, circulating alongside the videos on social media of travelers at airports being berated and worse for speaking Spanish or another foreign language. It's not unusual to have a chart-topping song sung in another language. Examples abound. No, it's not unusual, but it is remarkable, because it's 2017, a time that shows repeatedly that the negative linguistic attitudes Americans feel about foreign languages bubbles over again and again. The Canadian megastar of that mix of bubblegum melodies and sexualized lyrics, Justin Bieber, took a turn at a remix of Despacito. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído. Bringing the tune even more worldwide notice and acclaim. Was he just hitching his wagon to a sure bet? You'd think he'd be a little more grateful then. But recently at a concert in a New York City nightclub, he couldn't remember the words to the song, the title of the song, which is also repeated a dozen times. He mockingly sang words that rhyme with Despacito, words like burrito, words that mock, not just the language, but those who speak it. If you're Hispanic in 2017 America, you can't be thin-skinned. Spanish speakers have endured a history of being silenced, kept from speaking Spanish in schools and all public spaces. To defend yourself, your culture, your roots, your language, you risk getting into a fray suitable for viral social media play. But do you stay silent instead? At a talk on the campus of Yale University I attended last summer, MacArthur genius poet, essayist, and playwright Claudia Rankine told a packed room of conference participants that what she calls the, quote, elegant use of silence will always be a strategy of control over the other, a way to excuse inaction, ignorance, a way to disguise racism while knowing it's exploding all around us, and to promote the sins of disrespect and the lack of curiosity about the other. She also talked about the, quote, trope of discounting people of color and reducing, for instance, Latinos to, quote, not really invisibility, not really black, she said, not really white. Poets write poetry, she said, but poets of color write race. Poets of color write ethnicity. Poets of color write sociology. How's that? How is it that if a writer of color writes a song, a story, a poem that's perceived as universal, we can champion it as maybe transcendent, almost, and we dangle the word mainstream before it as if the designation means more than the truth? But the topic was bubblegum pop, right? A catchy tune with a good beat that you can dance to? For me, however, Rankine's words still apply. In this country, Latinos are all but invisible. a truly silent minority whose mother tongue is degraded as dirty. This song, like most songs in nearly all genres, from country to hip-hop to reggaeton, is about a romanticized sexual relationship. Now there's a universal theme of contemporary music. Fonsi and his crew penned a song with Spanish lyrics, and we can't just accept that for what it is. We have to take it as a sociological experiment to be stretched out and prodded by news outlets like the well-intentioned Washington Post with its elaborate graphs about the song's meteoric ascent on the Billboard charts and a quirky comparative analysis to La Bamba and Rock Me Amadeus. Then we examine the inevitable whitewashing with the addition of English language lyrics that ostensibly give it some kind of legitimacy and can only hope that in spite of the mocking, the silencing, the marketing machinations of this one hit, Spanish, the language, endures, and its considerable import be recognized thoughtfully, deliberately, despacito.
Despacito. Yvette Benavides is a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio, Texas. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.